From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As tens of thousands of welfare recipients are forced to work for their benefits, union organizing campaigns begin around the country. Then a look at a new report on conditions workers face in Nike plants in Vietnam.
Every single Nike worker that I spoke to told me that she could not live on her wage. The basic wage for a factory worker, a Nike factory worker, is $1.60 per day. But the cost of eating simple meals is about $2.
I'm saying go visit your Foot Locker and say, what do you know about Vietnam? And what do you know about Indonesia? And are you satisfied with what Nike's telling you about the conditions in these factories? And put the pressure on them that way.
And sicking dogs on teenagers, using a taser gun for an extended period on a schizophrenic man who then dies. Charges of police abuse rock a California town, hailed as a model of police conduct in the state. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The New Age cult leader who died with 38 followers in a mass suicide was a former music teacher who was preaching a mix of scripture and UFOs as far back as the 70s. Marshall Applewhite was identified today as one of those found dead Wednesday at the cult's palatial home near San Diego. Investigators believe the 21 women and 18 men drank a lethal mixture of phenobarbital and vodka and then settled back to die. Authorities wrestled with a dizzying onslaught of information about the Heaven's Gate cult from multiple sources, a book, the internet, acquaintances from Michigan to New Mexico, and calls from relatives of the victims. The victims apparently believe their human bodies were just temporary vessels and that their deaths would lead to a rendezvous with a UFO trailing the Hale-Bopp comet, which passed closest to Earth last weekend. The group had posted a statement on its worldwide website that said, "Hale-Bopp's approach is the marker we've been waiting for. We are happily prepared to leave this world." Group members who supported themselves by running a computer business had sent out videos in which their leader described the hoped-for space encounter. Members came before the camera two at a time, side by side, to say their last goodbyes. This news from Louisiana, lawyers for Dow Chemical deny that the firm hid research indicating that silicone breast implants were dangerous, a claim made by the plaintiffs during opening arguments of the nation's first class-action trial concerning the implants. Thousands of women say their implants leaked and caused illnesses, including arthritis, lupus, and scleroderma. President Alberto Fujimori of Peru says efforts to release 72 hostages held in the Japanese ambassador's residence have advanced, and he encouraged the captives with optimistic words about freedom. Face-to-face talks have been stalled since March 12th, with negotiators at an impasse over the guerrilla demand that at least 300 jailed rebels be freed. Peru's negotiator Domingo Palermo, the education minister, was expected to meet rebel leader Nestor Serpa on Monday. The two sides reportedly are close to a deal under which the hostages would be freed and the guerrillas would receive asylum in Cuba, a multi-million dollar payoff, and the promise of early release for some but not all of their jailed comrades. In the largest protest since President Boris Yeltsin was reelected in Russia, 1.8 million workers, angered by unpaid wages, walked off their jobs yesterday, marching behind red banners in hundreds of cities from Moscow to Vladivostok. Long lines of workers paraded through the main streets and squares, demanding the government lead the country out of its economic crisis. The day of action, called by Russia's main trade union federation, was the biggest anti-government protest in the country since the collapse of the Soviet Union. A federal immigration judge in Manhattan yesterday rejected the government's effort to deport a former Irish Republican Army volunteer who'd served 12 years in prison, saying that his 1975 bombing attack on a police barracks in Northern Ireland was not a terrorist act. In refusing to deport the man, Brian Desmond Pearson, now a carpenter, Judge Philip Williams called the attack a political offense. Judge Williams wrote that he made the distinction after considering the nature of the political situation in Northern Ireland at the time, as well as the, quote, context, mode, target, and purpose of the attack. The National Cancer Institute urged women in their 40s to get mammograms every year or two as a means of cutting breast cancer deaths. President Clinton also called on private insurers to cover the costs of the tests. Federal officials hope the new guidelines will quell a controversy over mammography's benefits, which was fueled by the National Cancer Institute itself, which had earlier expressed concern about the adverse health effects of mammograms. And Martin Luther King's son, Dexter King, met with James Earl Ray at a Tennessee prison. Dexter King asked, "Did you kill my father?" Ray emphatically denied shooting the civil rights leader in 1968. He said, "King said, I believe you." The family backs a trial for Ray, who's 69 years old and believed to be close to death. And you're listening to Democracy Now! The controversial new welfare law that President Clinton signed just before last year's election denies benefits to single women with children after 5 years, regardless of their ability to find work or child care. The new law also requires about a quarter of recipients this year and a half by the year 2002 to work for benefits. Now, all across the country, local governments are creating new work programs for welfare recipients, programs commonly referred to as workfare. Joining us first to talk about the issue and the national major developments around workfare is Maurice Emsalem, who is a staff attorney with the National Employment Law Project. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Maurice.
Good morning.
Well, why don't you tell us about the whole story, the picture of workfare right now?
Well, the federal law was passed in August, and what it requires, as you mentioned, is that there's now a time limit on welfare benefits of 5 years and a work participation requirement on the states where they have to place at least 50% of their caseload in what's called work activities by the year 2000. And that means at least 30 hours of work by the year 2000 for individual participants. That means that about 1 to 2 million new workers, it's estimated, will enter the low-wage labor market. New welfare recipients will enter the low-wage labor market, which translates into significant pressure to displace other workers and bring wages down for those workers. One estimate of the wage impact is that it would reduce the wages nationally by 12% for the lowest third of the labor market, and a larger decrease in states like New York with high populations of public assistance recipients. So since there are no jobs available, and given the time limit and the work requirements, there's significant pressure, especially in high unemployment areas like urban areas and rural areas, to create workfare programs to meet these work requirements. For example, in New York, there's the program that requires the workfare program, the largest in the country, that has right now about 37,000 recipients at any one time on the program. They've put about 75,000 through, where they have to work for 20 to 30 hours in return for their welfare benefits. And they're working in serious physical labor jobs, all sorts of work that you'll hear more about from the other panelists. The fact is, however, that the states don't have to adopt workfare programs. There's a lot of discretion in this bill to define what is work activities, and it can include training and other activities to get up to those 30 hours of work. And that's the battleground right now in the states as they implement this federal law in New York and most other states. Legislatures are now debating how they're going to define what is work requirements. A lot of them, in the end, are going to turn to workfare.
Could you clear up something for me that I've been wondering about a lot, and that is the issue of workfare as corporate welfare. Who is paying for example, a corporation to take on a welfare recipient? Do they get benefits from the government?
Well, it happens in basically two ways. I mean, and under this bill, they promote both options. One is that there are a lot of tax credits and other kinds of subsidies that will be made available to corporations to hire welfare recipients. That's to actually hire them. The other way that it happens is that there's what they call grant diversion programs, which means that the employer takes the recipient's check, cashes it out, and if required by the state law, pays up to the minimum wage or whatever is required. But that's the situation, and we've seen some examples of that, of private sector workfare.
I don't understand. What do you mean by that? That the employer cashes out the check?
Yeah, the employer gets the check from the welfare department, the individual's check from the welfare department. It's called work supplementation or grant diversion. And they take the check, they cash it, and then they cut a check, a paycheck in theory, to the welfare recipient, which is different from workfare in the sense that the welfare recipient gets their welfare check directly from the government.
Uh-huh.
So what's interesting, I think, is that there's also a lot of, in terms of private sector involvement in this program, there's a lot of emphasis on getting temp agencies involved in placing welfare recipients, which has special consequences for welfare recipients because temp agencies are notorious for discriminating. It's been documented, and there's a lot of concerns about the kind of turnover that you're promoting by placing welfare recipients into temp work.
New York has the largest program, around what you said, 37,000 workers. California, Los Angeles, is that next with how many, 16,000?
Yeah, Los Angeles has about 16,000. Ohio has about 11. But those are different programs. It's important to emphasize. Right now we're looking at the emphasis of placement of AFDC, welfare moms with kids, into workfare jobs. In Los Angeles, it's mostly the general assistance program right now, which is single adults on welfare.
Now, unions are taking on this issue in a big way. In February in Los Angeles, in this unprecedented meeting of the AFL-CIO, they usually have their annual meeting in Bal Harbour, Florida, but decided to leave the resort for an urban area with this new approach of John Sweeney. They passed a resolution that said that they were going to take on the issue of workfare and begin organizing drives of workfare recipients. What about this?
I think it's a fantastic development, and I think they're very serious about it. You know, I think certainly the national leadership is serious about it, and in places like L.A., service employees union locals are starting to make that happen, and I think probably the folks in L.A. can speak more to that.
Well, let's take in a few more of our guests. Amy Scher is joining us from Los Angeles, an organizer with the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, known as ACORN, which has been taking a leading role in organizing around welfare in Los Angeles. And we've been joined in our New York studio by Juan Galan, who is a welfare recipient, and he is also a workfare worker. I guess the city would call you workfare recipient. It's hard to, because they don't like to call workfare recipients employees. The program in New York is called the WEP program, the Work Experience Program. Amy Scher, what about the picture in Los Angeles right now? How and why are you organizing workfare workers?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, as Maurice mentioned, there's here in L.A. general relief recipients in the county who receive a welfare check of $212 a month, or what for many people has now gone down to $179 a month plus food stamps, are required to work off those benefits. Right now, they are working in public sector jobs, city, county, school district. They are performing vital tasks at these different locations, work that has to get done in many cases. And so, number one, they're being exploited. I mean, they are performing work that other people, unions have fought hard that work would be compensated with a decent wage. And now you've got people doing the work getting no wage, or if you want to do the math, getting minimum wage or in some cases less to do that work.
Do you have actual evidence that they're replacing workers, low-paid workers, with workfare workers?
Well, I mean, if you look at the city and county in Los Angeles right now, they have hiring freezes. And if you look at the number of County General Hospital, where we've done a lot of organizing and we have a lot of members, every day they have upwards around 100 general relief workers doing work there. Some are outside cleaning the grounds, but many are inside the hospital cleaning patients' rooms, performing all sorts of tasks that have to get done for that hospital to operate. So there is no, and we've talked to many of the full-time regular employees themselves who are now supervising general relief workfare workers, and they've told us, you know, look, if I didn't have these guys helping out doing this work, we couldn't do the job. They would have to hire more people to do the work.
Well, we're joined by a workfare recipient here in New York, a workfare worker, Juan Galan. Juan, what is your job in New York City?
I'm in the Bronx 7 garage in the sanitation department, 215th Street and Broadway.
Now, before you were part of the workfare program, you were receiving general assistance?
Mm-hmm.
And then what were you told?
Well, once I got on home relief, I pretty much was a WEP worker automatically.
WEP worker being work experience program.
Right. I was in the Parks Department beforehand in New York City. From there, you know, I held on long enough because they had a training there called the PAC training. It's pretty much an augmented WEP program. It's designed supposedly to train you. But in the type of trainings they were training people in, and in the job placements that they have, let's just say you were being trained in one field, but the job interviews you were being sent on had nothing to do with the field that you were being trained on.
So what do you do in the sanitation department?
Sanitation, I pretty much am a street sweeper. I pick up also garbage. I deal a lot with dead animals. I pick up human feces, animal feces. There's been times we've picked up garbage in a site where rats were literally pouring out from the garbage. We've been left unsupervised as well. I've also picked up refrigerators, stoves, furniture as well.
Now, some people might say to you, well, you're getting general assistance. You should have to work for that. What is your response to that?
Well, I understand in life that nothing is free. I can understand that I have to work for the benefits, but for the type of work that I'm doing, I should be getting a decent wage.
What kind of wage are you getting?
The way I break it down, I'm getting $168.50 every 2 weeks in cash, $120 in food stamps. The type of work I'm doing the work equal to the sanitation workers.
How do the sanitation workers feel about you doing their work?
We're pretty much, we're pretty much prejudiced against for the simple fact we're on public assistance because we're stigmatized in a sense, well, you're on public assistance, you pretty much are lazy and you don't want to work. Which fact of the matter, I pretty much have a long work history. And so do other people in the work experience program as well. And, you know, we're all being forced in this category that, well, because you're on public assistance, you just don't want to work. And that's not the case. You know, because fact of the matter, when you look at these city streets right now and you look in the parks, they've never been this cleaner. And that has to do with the work experience program people. We're the ones that are doing all their work while the supervisors are sitting nice and warm and in their trucks and in their vans.
Do you know how much your pay comes to an hour?
No, I haven't, but I know it's on the minimum wage.
So you've been organizing here.
Yeah.
And there have been major protests.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about them?
Well, we've been up to Albany, New York. We spoke to the Solidarity Committee up there. We were pretty much exposing the WEP program for what it is. You know, we were told in orientation, you know, either where in parks or the sanitation department, that this program is designed for us to better ourselves. But you have, in this program, they're pulling people out of college to stick them in workfare. Now, if this program is designed for people to better themselves, if someone is trying to better themselves right now by going to college or what have you, or trying to pursue their GED, how could they better themselves if you're denying them their education and sticking them in workfare?
It's interesting. Yesterday there was a piece in the New York Times about this one young woman who is a mother and goes to the College of Staten Island and has a 3.7 grade point average, and they have forced her out of school. And she said, well, that she would give up the assistance then because she wanted to remain in school.
Yeah, there's, so far as I see, a lot of people are doing that. They're trying to, like I said, they're trying to pull out people from college. And people are just refusing. They'll stick with the college and they're trying to figure out a way around it.
Are unions trying to recruit you?
Well, so far, the ones that have really done any type of impact with us at all is ACORN. As soon as ACORN popped on the scene and started trying to organize the WEP workers and everything, little by little, we did start to see some results on the sites. We started getting the actual work gear that we were supposed to be getting. A lot of the times we were denied our actual work gear. In the site that I was in, the supervisor tried to charge the WEP workers $2 for the gloves. And these are gloves that are already paid for to be given to us. But the supervisor, I guess, I don't know if he was trying to make a buck on the side or what have you, but he was trying to charge $2 for the workers for the work gloves.
Amy Scher, is this something you find in Los Angeles, the issue of protective clothing, for example, that's given to regular workers doing these jobs that workfare recipients, workfare workers don't get?
Oh, absolutely. To give a couple examples, at the Museum of Natural History, where we've got an organizing committee, every day at the back of the museum, they have workfare workers loading and unloading the exhibits, which are hundreds of pounds being loaded and unloaded off of trucks. They have one regular employer who's on the forklift and then anywhere from 6 to 12 workfare workers. They don't have back braces, which is sort of a basic, obvious need. And they said that their supervisor has told them, we think you'll rip them off, walk off with them, so we're not going to provide them. At County General Hospital, you've got people working with extremely strong cleaning, fluids to clean the hospitals, disinfect the hospitals, and they weren't given masks, which is, you know, a requirement under Cal OSHA laws.
We're going to come back to this discussion in just a minute to get some final comments from each of you and to bring Maurice Ensalem back into this discussion of where workfare goes from here and will cities, states, and the federal government have to deal with this new, what they call unpaid labor force, even call say that they're not employees. But where do we go from here? After that, we're going to talk about another group of workers, this group of workers in Vietnam, who are working for Nike here in the United States. And finally, we're going to talk about a police brutality case in California. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and our guests, Maurice Ensalem, staff attorney with the National Employment Law Project, Juan Galan, a welfare recipient in New York City, part of the New York Workfare Program, and Amy Schur, an organizer with ACORN in Los Angeles, taking a leading role in organizing welfare recipients in Los Angeles. I wanted to get final comments from you, Juan, on your reflections and your experience here in New York and what you're calling for now.
Well, right now, we're not being recognized as actual workers. We do want that. We want to be recognized as actual workers like that. Once we're recognized as workers, we can organize. In this program, they're calling it a work experience program. In my opinion, the E in the WEP stands for exploitation. We are all being exploited. This is nothing but a form of legalized slavery. Instead of cracking whips, they're just cracking a welfare check. You pretty much have everybody working for room and board with threats of termination and sanctions against your welfare case. And I think that's pretty much unjust. I understand nothing in life is for free, but if people are going to be working for their benefits, they should be treated with some type of respect and dignity because we are human beings.
You know, you were talking about what the E stands for, the program in New York called the WEP program, the Work Experience Program. I was looking at an article in a magazine called City Limits, which calls WEP Workers Expect Paychecks. Amy Schur, your work in Los Angeles, what do you see happening now in the next year as we move from a quarter of people on welfare going into workfare to a half by the year 2002?
Right. I mean, for all the reasons we've talked about on this program, we think the workfare program through and through is a wrong solution to welfare to work. And so what ACORN members are doing is not only fighting the immediate issue to say that if we're out there doing the work, we are workers, we deserve workers' rights and decent pay, but where are the jobs? So ACORN members are mobilizing in LA and New York and throughout the country to sort of start forcing a debate in all this discussion about welfare and welfare to work that says we have got to look at creating more jobs. So what we want to see out of the mobilizing of our members of ACORN throughout L.A. is a jobs program, whether it's like what CETA used to be or some kind of public service employment program that puts people to work with real jobs that pay a living wage.
Can I get your phone number of ACORN in Los Angeles for people who are interested in getting in touch with you there?
That would be great. It's area code 213-747-4211.
That's 213-747-4211 on the West Coast. And Juan Galan, do you know the number here in New York?
Yeah, the area code is for the Bronx office, 718-292-0070.
0070, 718-292-0070. And finally, Maurice Ensalem, your work with the National Employment Law Project. Where are you going from here?
Well, I think as you've heard from Juan and Amy, I think the focus is shifting largely to the status of these folks as workers and whether basic employment laws are going to come in and treat them like workers. And there's a myth out there, basic employment laws like the right to minimum wage, health and safety, and probably most important for the purposes of keeping the pressure on is the right to organize. And there's a myth out there, that those rights don't exist for workfare participants. They do, in fact, and our challenge here is to really start to enforce those rights and give the workers a chance to express their rights as workers.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for joining us. Do you want to give a number of the National Law Employment
Project? Number is 212-285-3025.
One more time?
212-285-3025.
Well, Maurice Ensalem, Amy Scher, and Juan Galán, I want to thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and again, when we come back after this short music break, we're going to talk about workers in another country, but connected directly to the United States. We'll talk about Nike workers in Vietnam.
I don't know, give me nothing, open up, I want nothing,
and you are listening to Democracy Now! Yesterday in New York, there was a news conference. You might read about it in the New York Times today. Bob Herbert has a very interesting piece called Brutality in Vietnam. Footwear giant Nike is in trouble again, this time for its labor practices in Vietnam. According to labor rights activists, Vietnamese women as young as 14 years old toil for low wages under harsh conditions to make 1 million Nike shoes a month. The U.S.-based group Vietnam Labor Watch says that 35,000 workers at the plants, 90% of them women, put in 12-hour days under dictatorial managers. Yesterday, Nike responded by suspending a plant manager and said they were distressed about the conditions. Well, joining us right now are the two people who held that news conference yesterday. We're joined by Thuyen Nguyen, who is a Vietnamese-American investment banker, former vice president of Bankers Trust, who now works with the Vietnam Labor Watch. He released a report, a damning 12-page report, on working conditions in Vietnam after a 16-day inspection of Nike's factories. And Jeff Ballinger joins us of the group Press for Change, a research and advocacy group that has been tracking Nike for years. Why don't we begin with Thuyen Nguyen? Can you talk about your experience in Vietnam following looking at the Nike plants and what you found?
I was very disturbed by what I found there. The pay was very low. People were not able to live on that kind of wage they're paying. For example, they were paying $1.60 a day when it cost about $2 to pay for meals. I also found the corporal punishment was horrible. You know, they would force these women to go through these punishment like running around the plants, kneeling down with their hands up in the air, hit them over the head. You know, on a day during my trip, International Women's Day, March 8, there were 12 Vietnamese women who were forced to run around the factory and they fainted. It was such a horrible thing to occur in Vietnam because that was the day when Vietnam honors women. You know, they have festivals there.
Wait, explain again what they were forced to do.
They were forced to run around the factories. Yeah, 56 of them were forced to run around the factory twice, a total distance of 4 kilometers, or like about 2 miles, and 12 of them fainted.
Why were they forced to run around the factory?
Because they wear the wrong... they wear the wrong regulation shoes.
You mean they weren't wearing Nike shoes?
No. They were wearing outdoor shoes inside the factory, and they want to keep the factory clean, I think. So they forced these women to run around the factory.
How did you end up going to Vietnam? By the way, I should say that we did invite Nike on the show today. Its headquarters are in Beaverton, Oregon, but they said they are still reviewing the report that you've put out, and so that they declined to come on now. Why did you end up going there?
In October 96, I watched a program on the treatment of Nike workers, and I became interested in this. So I started contacting labor groups and talking to people in Vietnam. Then I took my information to Nike, and I showed them, and they go, okay. They also invited me to go to Vietnam to visit the factories.
Nike invited you?
Yeah. They invited me in December, and then I went in March.
And what did they take you to see? Did Nike take you to the plants?
Yeah, they gave me an official tour, a 2-3 hours official tour of one plant. And then after that, during the tour, the women, none of them wanted to talk to me, so I didn't know what to do. So I say, I'm going to stay and do some more investigation myself. And they go, okay. And I was there, and I'd make a surprise visit, and I stand in front of the factories to talk to the women.
And what did they tell you?
They told me a lot of, the most memorable thing for me was this young girl. She must be 18 or something. And I asked her, how are they treating you? And this was late at night. I waited outside doing the night shift, and she looked at me and she go, they treated us like animals. I was just shocked after that.
What did Nike say to you? I assume you talked to them about what you found, or is your last contact with them that official trip?
Well, I talked to them. I called the Nike officials and talked to them, but we get into a lot of arguments about various complexities. So, but basically, my feeling is that they don't want to step on the toes of these contractors. They don't want to change anything. And so I was really mad at them for not making a conscious effort to change these factories. And that's why I came back and try to release this information to the public.
Jeff Ballinger, you've been looking at Nike's practices for quite a time now. You started in Indonesia. You're looking at Vietnam. Does what Thea Nguyen is telling us surprise you?
No, not in the least, Amy. In fact, it's chilling almost when we read this report or saw it on television about these 15 women beaten by a supervisor. 2 years earlier in Indonesia, I'd heard exactly the same story, 15 quality control inspectors beaten by their supervisors. And I informed Nike about this, much the same way Tian did, and so they know exactly what's going on in these factories, and they really haven't gone eyeball to eyeball with their contractors to say this is just not acceptable anymore.
What is contractors and subcontractors? What does this mean?
Well, this is very important because not all American corporations are contracting out their work. Gillette, for example, in Indonesia is running its own factory, paying double or triple the minimum wage, and you'd never find them cheating or beating workers. This is just not acceptable, and a Western manager, I don't think, would do that. But in the case of Nike, and I must say most large apparel manufacturers, Levi's among them, they're using contractors where they either don't want to or can't control them because they're looking for the most goods for the lowest cost, and these contractors don't want to hear pay more than a minimum wage or give them weekends off or be more responsible in your behavior because they sweated to get that contract. They're going to try and fatten their bottom line by oppressing these workers and getting the most out of them. That's the problem.
Now, for a long time now, companies like Nike have said that subcontractors are not responsible for. How has the line been broken down, that wall, when they say, well, we try to make our contractors, subcontractors, abide by certain rules, but they are separate companies?
Well, this has been an interesting development over the 8 years that I've been involved since I first saw Nike's operations come to Indonesia. First 4 years, Nike said, well, these aren't our factories. It's not our problem. Your beef is with the contractor. And then in 1992, they drew up their code of conduct, did a 180-degree turn and said, oh, of course we're in charge of these factories. Look, every contractor has to sign this code of conduct, this memorandum of understanding. 2 years later, when the stories of abuse kept coming out, they said, oh, we've hired Ernst & Young, this accounting firm, to go around and spot check all of these factories and be assured that our code of conduct is being enforced. And even 2 years later, they said, now we've hired Andrew Young, and of course he's got the reputation, he's got the moral authority, he shows that we're really serious about this. Now we're talking about 8 years of just public relations, smoke and mirrors,
And we're not sure that the Andrew Young thing is going to be any more than that.
Talk a little about Andrew Young. Now, he's already taken his trip over. Did he head to Vietnam or to Indonesia?
He was going to Vietnam, China, and Indonesia. And, you know, starting from scratch and going with Nike, we're really not sure if he's going to get off the tour, so to speak, and see workers away from the factory with people they trust and would talk frankly in front of. And this is a very important point that, that Tuyen, especially because he is Vietnamese and could speak with these workers himself away from the factory, it really points up the what we've been calling for years, independent monitoring by indigenous groups.
Tuyen.
Yeah, I could describe you my tours. You know, they have, when I enter the factory, they have several people following me around, and they even have people who speak Koreans and Vietnamese follow me around. So I couldn't really talk to anyone. Like, for example, I would sit down at the lunch counter, and these women would, like, all 12 of them would get up and leave. And I have to follow them. I have to follow them. And I say, can we sit down and talk? And they were like, look at me like, you know, like they're so afraid. And so I didn't ask them many questions during the tour because there were just so much intimidations.
What do you think of Andrew Young being hired by Nike? I mean, there are different ways to do this. We know Ernst & Young was hired by Nike, and then no one could get the results of their evaluation of Nike because it was the proprietary information of Nike.
Well, I can comment on the Ernst & Young a little bit because while I was there, Ernst & Young was conducting an audit. This is 18 months after the factory has been operating. So they have not been there, done any audit for 18 months. Obviously, Nike wouldn't be able to know until the audit is done. Now, about Andrew Young, you know, Ambassador Young is a famous person, and I hope he'll do the right things. But I think he has a lot of work to be done in Vietnam. There's just there are a lot of problems with the Nike factories there.
Jeff Ballinger, you spoke to Andrew Young.
Yeah, I did. And as I said, he's starting from scratch, basically, on the worker rights question. And but it's not that there aren't a lot of groups out there who've been studying this for some time. So if he shows good faith and talks to Nike's critics, among them the Methodist Church Pension Fund, who had a resolution before the shareholders meeting last year, and Global Exchange, who had a human rights tour put together largely, I might add, because of Pacifica, and Global Exchange heard about the Nike in Indonesia story on one of your broadcasts and got hooked up with me, and they organized our press conference here in New York yesterday and made a tremendous contribution. So Ambassador Young, if he seeks out the right information from people who've been studying this for years, I think he can really make a contribution. But, you know, on this tour, he's over there with Nike. And as I say, he has to get off the tour and on his own.
Medea Benjamin, one of the co-directors of Global Exchange, was quoted in the New York Times as saying that she didn't think he should accept employment by Nike on this issue.
I think she had a tremendous take on this whole thing, and she's obviously given it a lot of thought, and that's something I heartily endorse her view of this. He should have been hired by a foundation. He should be an independent mediator. He should be able to say what he really thinks and not be worried about down the road maybe another contract with another company.
Now, it looks like Nike is beefing up its PR. I see on the first line of Bob Herbert's piece in the New York Times today, Brutality in Vietnam, "That was horrible," said McLean Ramsey, the chief spokeswoman for the Nike footwear empire. "That was definitely horrible. Nike is definitely outraged that that was allowed to happen in the factory." And she's talking about exactly what Tien was just describing, the women being forced to run around the plant until they fainted. Who is the spokesperson? Because this is a new name. I'm familiar with Donna Gibbs. We've had her on Democracy Now!, McLean Ramsey.
McLean Ramsey comes from NBC, not as a journalist, but as a public relations person, but it's definitely a step up for Nike's public relations department. Their public relations before, I believe, was really reflected what Phil Knight, the CEO, thinks about these matters. And that is that, look, as he told Joseph Tam, the school board member of Portland City Schools, who once suggested that the Portland schools reject $500,000 from Nike because their kids shouldn't benefit from the sweat of Asian kids. He told Joseph Tam about independent monitoring. He says, look, I'm not going to have anybody tell me how to run my factories in Asia. And Donna Gibbs, as you mentioned, was at PR before with Nike. She just reflected Phil Knight's view. Now, I think the hiring of McLean Ramsey shows that somebody sat Phil Knight down and said, hey, look, we have to put a professional in charge of this. And, you know, so maybe their PR improves. We want to see their production practices improve.
Tien, do you have anything to say to people like Andre Agassi and Spike Lee and Michael Jordan, who are getting tens of millions of dollars from Nike to promote the company? I know that when Michael Jordan was asked about it, he said it's not his responsibility. You talked about the workers in Vietnam getting $1.60 a day, despite the fact that their three meals cost $2 a day.
I really hope that these star athletes talk to Nike and ask them to change their labor practices. I think it's kind of unconscionable that they would be promoting a brand name that are, you know, promoting a company that are violating many labor rights and exploiting workers in Vietnam and Indonesia and China.
Let me get some phone numbers for people who want to get in touch with the Vietnam Labor Watch Group and also Jeff Ballinger, your Press for Change and Global Exchange.
Vietnam Labor Watch is, the number is 212-996-0013. We're also on the web. Just go to Yahoo and do a search for Nike and you will see our website.
Don't get it confused with, I guess, what Nike's website would be, but that's 212-996-0013, the Vietnam Labor Watch. And Jeff?
I'm going to give the number for the Campaign for Labor Rights, which is a project of the Nicaragua Network, because Trim Bissell is really coordinating volunteers and activists around the country in this campaign. It's 541-344-5410.
That's 541-344-5410. Jeff Ballinger and Tien Nguyen, I want to thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to take a look at police conduct in one town in California. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. For many communities nationwide, police brutality has become an all-too-common occurrence. In fact, many human rights activists believe the situation is growing steadily worse in the United States. And it's not unusual these days to see reports from major human rights organizations, like Amnesty International, being compiled on police departments in some big cities. But now out of California comes one case that shocked even veteran police observers. The small-bedroom community of Fairfield, a town of around 90,000 lying halfway between San Francisco and Sacramento, has been rocked by charges that the local police department is wildly out of control. But Fairfield is also significant because of the response of many of the town's residents, who've banded together in recent months to try and reassert some kind of police accountability. I'm joined now by Dennis Bernstein, a producer at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, who has been reporting on this story, most recently for the weekly newspaper, the San Francisco Bay Guardian. He wrote a piece with KPFA producer Julie Light. And we're also joined by Dan Parkinson, a Fairfield resident and member of Citizens for Police Review Board, and Willa Jackson. Both of them have quite amazing personal stories to tell. Dennis, thanks for bringing this to our attention this week in your piece in the San Francisco Bay Guardian.
It's a pleasure. Nice to talk to you again, Amy.
Well, why don't you tell us how you discovered the story in Fairfield?
Well, Amy, we began to get phone calls and messages that something terrible was going on up north of here. I have to be honest with you, when I began to hear the stories, it was incomprehensible, because the violence that appeared and that was being alleged against the police department was overwhelming. So we began to call up there and to speak to different people, and one after another, they told these stories. So Julie Light and myself began to investigate. We got a copy of all the police documents, the complaints. There are lawsuits going in six different directions here, and it really is a scene. So we began to speak with people like our guests in the studio here, Dan Parkinson and also Willa Jackson. And let me let them introduce themselves. Let me start with you, Dan Parkinson. Why don't you give us a little bit of a history, because you and Willer have very interesting divergent histories. Why don't you talk a little bit about your background in Fairfield?
Sure. My family came to Fairfield, or I should say my father came to Fairfield in about 1958 through the military. He was a physician in the Air Force, and we've lived there for ever since then. I was born and raised in Fairfield. I'm 35 years old, born in 1961, and my father's practiced medicine there for, you know, approximately 35 years.
Conservative credentials.
Very
conservative. You consider yourself conservative, right?
Very conservative. We're Mormon.
Voted for Reagan.
Voted for Reagan.
Bush, Dole.
Right.
The governor of this state.
Yes, I'm a conservative Republican.
All the way through.
And still consider myself to be so.
Why don't you tell people what happened to your brother on June 7th when he was found naked and bloody at an apartment complex, running around a pool, rather troubled.
My brother was schizophrenic, and he was under the care of a facility in Fairfield that was under contract by the county. The facility is named Stargate, and he had been there a very short time. He had a schizophrenic episode and left the facility. The police were called. He had subsequently removed his clothing, stripped his clothing off. He wasn't in his right mind. And the police subsequently pepper sprayed him multiple times.
On his naked body.
On his naked body. Sprayed him all over and tasered him, and he subsequently died.
Explain what you mean by tasered.
A taser weapon is a gun that shoots two little projectiles that have wired leads that come off of them. These little barbs embed into the skin of the victim. And then the police officer administers electrical current to that person for some period of time to subdue them.
So they pepper sprayed him multiple times. They gave him these jolts. According to the police report, he got jolts that lasted as long as 20 seconds, recommended dosage between 3 and 5 seconds.
That's right.
And then what happened?
He died. He went into convulsions, and he died on the spot. There at the apartment complex.
Now, according to the police report, the man, the officer who tasered him, then later noticed that he had gone into convulsions. According to the police report, he kicked your brother in the heels as a way of working him out of the convulsions. What was your response to that, and did you attempt to ask the authorities why they did that?
We were so shocked when we heard that. I had gotten a copy of the police report, and I was at the coroner's inquest when that was described to me. My brother had taken his shoes off. He didn't have any shoes. He didn't have any clothes on at the time, and his skin was worn completely off the soles of his feet. And when I heard that officer had kicked him in the soles to stop a convulsion, it just my heart sank. I mean, And every time I think about that to this day, I become very emotional.
That's Dan Parkinson. Also, Amy, in the studio with us is Willa Jackson. Willa Jackson moved in 1993 from Oakland, California, to Fairfield with her family. Willa, why did you leave Oakland?
I left Oakland, first of all, to give my six children that I have a better sense of life, a better style. And I left because on a Monday, we got home, had just walked in the door. 5 minutes later, a 15-year-old was shot dead in the driveway by drive-by. And I decided this was enough. The neighborhood was rough. Let's go find a quiet place. And that was a Monday, and that Friday, that's how quick I moved. I moved to Fairfield.
So you were running and trying to escape from this gang violence, street violence, tough neighborhood, and you found yourself right facing a wall of police brutality. Right. Why don't you tell people about what happened on December 14th? You were having a party for your children. Six chaperones, adult chaperones, were there. Mm-hmm. The kids were bringing in the equipment. Police came at 9 o'clock. They were still bringing in the equipment. They gave you a written complaint. They said that it was a noisy party. It hadn't begun yet. They came back 40 minutes later. Tell us what it was like when they came back.
Well, when they came back 45 minutes later, they came back and said that the party had to be dispersed. I complied, told the children it was over. As the children came out, and they was noticing one officer, and that officer is Troy Freeman. And the kids kept saying, this is the officer that was doing and saying certain things to him.
Saying what?
Certain things like, you little nigga, you know.
Saying it when?
Really, beg your pardon?
Saying it when?
This is when the kids were going out of my backyard, and they noticed Officer Freeman. But while Officer Freeman was standing there, he made a statement saying there was too many of them in there. And I mean, what do you mean, too many children? He sort of stepped back and he said it was too many niggas. And I'm asking him, what does that have to do with anything? If these kids were doing something wrong, in spite of the color, you do your job, you know. He was standing next to a sergeant, a police sergeant, that didn't say Freeman leave the scene or anything.
Even though he was referring to the kids in your
right.
house as niggers.
Right.
So talk about how the police acted at that point. What happened then?
Okay, the kids left my address, and they stood across the street a little bit in shock. Now, what are we going to do? We don't have any place to go.
Standing there in a suburban neighborhood,
right.
nothing else around but
nothing
houses.
Nothing around them but houses. Mm. The police then formed a skirmish line, and they got the canine dog out of the
They
unit.
Took the dog out.
And they walked on these kids with their batons, the dog. And actually, if you've never seen anything, you would have thought you was in the civil rights movement.
Hmm.
And the only thing they was missing was a water hose.
So you're saying that it was like a flashback to...
Right. You know, and the kids went scattering everywhere.
How many kids were there?
I had approximately about 75.
So there were 75 kids. How many cops were there?
I had 20 car units from different agencies. Solano County, surrounding Sassoon, Fairfield. I had at least 20 cars.
Now, Amy, it's important to note that according to the protocols of the Fairfield Police Department, they are not to use dogs for crowd control. When I spoke with the chief of police, Mr. Doug Millender, he said that this was a volatile, dangerous crowd. Talk about your children. You've got a child now in college.
I have a son that's in Sierra College. I have a son that's graduating from Fairfield High.
Was this a volatile, violent situation?
No. Even with that statement Chief Millender made, his own investigator from that department said he saw no signs of a riot. So where was the conflict? There's a conflict of interest. Those kids did not riot. They said bottles was thrown. No bottles was thrown. The next morning, I even videotaped the area. It was calm. When you have signs of riot, something is tore up. The area was calm. You know, there was no glass, nothing, out of place.
Dan Parkinson, you are now suing for constitutional violations of your brother's constitutional rights, wrongful death action. What have you heard from the police?
They basically are not going to comment on my brother's case, although I did have a discussion with the police chief after a city council meeting where we all had gotten up and spoken. And he told me that they had not killed my brother, that he died of a heart attack. And I told him
he was 25.
Yeah. I told him that point. I said, look, all I know is he was alive before he was pepper sprayed and tasered, and he was dead afterwards. He was very healthy. He was a cross-country runner. He was in very good health. I did address at that point concerning another case with my father, which you're aware of, where my father's constitutional rights were violated, and he couldn't respond to that at all because that case had already been settled to some degree by a judge who ruled that his constitutional rights were violated.
Now, in terms of the pepper spray and the Tasertron, your brother may very well been on some medications at the time that they both pepper sprayed him and shot him with the electronic taser gun. According to protocols, that the synergistic effects of pepper spray and taser used with psychotropic drugs could be deadly. Was there any attempt at trying to ascertain your brother's care at the time, the medications at the time? Were there any medical people on the scene when the cops were subduing him with this material?
No. They had been notified that there was a man with some sort of mental distress about the facility, so they knew that he was obviously a troubled individual. That's one of the questions that I've been asking. The uses of these so-called means, non-lethal means of force, are they appropriate with these kinds of individuals that have mental problems or that may be on medications or even drugs for that matter? And there does seem to be a common thread amongst some of these cases of these in-custody deaths where people are agitated or mentally disturbed and they subsequently die.
Dan Parkinson and Dennis, just let me get in here for a second. We do have to wrap up, and I wanted to ask Dan Parkinson and Willa Jackson about the organization that you're both a part of, Citizens for Police Review Board. Now, Dennis, in your article, you wrote about how Frank Riggs, the Congress member from the area, and California State Attorney General Dan Lundgren have both made visits to Fairfield, and that Riggs congratulated the department for making real strides in fighting youth crime. According to him, Fairfield's cops are in line to receive a large portion of the money allocated to California this year from the 94 federal crime bill. And he cited as a reason for this the county's high number of youth arrests on both felony and misdemeanor charges. And Lundgren talked about Fairfield in many ways, saying it's a role model for the state. So tell us about your Citizens for Review Board and how far you've gotten with it.
We've only been organized for a very short period of time, but a lot of different people have come together from different backgrounds, different religious backgrounds and ethnic makeups. And we've been able to have some progress on this matter concerning a police review commission for our town.
The idea that civilians would review police conduct?
Yeah, that's one of our major concerns, is that when a complaint's made, you make it to the police and they police themselves, and there's a conflict there. And we want to see that changed, and we have some movement in our community now to see that changed. You made reference to Riggs and Lundgren coming in recently. I'm a Republican. I voted for them. I think maybe they don't have a full understanding of what's going on in our area, and I would hope that they would come to some understanding concerning our complaints, their legitimate complaints.
Well, what about this, Willa? As a model, they say this is a model, Fairfield is a model for the way police should act. What's your response to that?
Only thing I say to them is that Lungen and Riggs and the politicians, they're not living in Fairfield. When they come, yes, they got the red carpet. But when they go back, they're not seeing what's happening besides what is reported on paper.
Now, haven't you been, ever since you got involved in this Police Civilian Review Board, I understand a number of people involved have been retaliated against.
I've been called and threatened and told I won't live to see tomorrow. And the bad thing about that, when I got that threatening call, I called the police for some assistance. It took them 2.5 days to come out.
It took them to, after a death threat?
The FBI had to call them and tell them to come take a report. And it's sort of scary because I'm out there for a change for the betterment, not for the worse. And the retaliation, the targets, I mean, been written up, slandered. And basically I was just a quiet person. And now I'm speaking out.
And Dan Parkinson, your brother-in-law was fired as the principal of an elementary school as he spoke out at a meeting for a civilian complaint review board?
That's right. 10 days after he spoke up on February 18th, he was notified that he was no longer going to be in the employ of the school district. He had been administrator for 9 years. He has subsequently filed suit in Superior Court for, among other things, First Amendment violations.
Well,
our family has been besieged by problems as related to this.
Dan, we have to go, but we are going to follow this story. And Dennis, I hope you will keep us updated. Dan Parkinson and Willa Jackson, both residents of Fairfield, California, dealing with issues of police misconduct in their community. Dennis Bernstein, producer at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, where all of our guests have been this morning. Thanks so much all for joining us. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our engineer and assistant producer. Thanks to Kevin Cartwright. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.